Hello listeners and welcome to Sportspiel, the podcast that demands almost as much respect as a certain Jose Mourinho. Respect, man. Joining me, as ever, to discuss all things sport is Mr. Will Moulton.
I refuse to respect you until you've won three podcasting titles.
Ooh. Challenge. We'll see. Challenge accepted. Anyway, it's been 3 weeks or so since we last recorded an episode. How has life been for you?
Life has been just as busy as it was before.
There was another event for you.
There was a four-day event which I led on, which was tiring.
Have you recovered fully yet?
If you'd have asked me that question yesterday, I would have said no. But I'm feeling a lot more human today, which is good.
It was nice.
I think it might
be
because the sun's back out.
So yeah, on the discussion section on this episode, we have got two topics lined up for you. The first being tennis and sexism after the fallout regarding Serena Williams' catsuit, Annalise Cornet's on-court violation for swapping her shirt around. After that, we will then talk England cricket, namely, what on earth is up with the batting as they continue to flounder in the series against India. On the feature interview section today, we have a fencer who has risen up to qualify for the upcoming Commonwealth Games in Australia. He also happens to be a former teammate of mine, and we were at university together. That man is Scottish sabre Anthony Sheck. All that and more on this episode of Sportspiel. The US Open is currently in full throttle over in New York, and all eyes should be on the final Grand Slam of the year. Except they're not. We're all talking about something else, and that's sexism. It all kicked off with superstar Serena Williams and the catsuit outfit she wore at this year's French Open. She likened it to feeling like a superhero, but she also wore it to aid her health, namely the blood clots that she has developed over the past few years. But prior to the start of the US Open, French Tennis Federation president Bernard Giudicelli said in a tennis magazine interview, "I think we sometimes went too far. The combination of Serena this year, for example, it will no longer be accepted. You have to respect the game and the place." The catsuit ban led to plenty of outrage before another piece to the sexism puzzle was added when French player Annalise Cornet briefly took her shirt off after accidentally putting it on the wrong way round at the US Open, and she received a code violation. But how often have we seen the likes of Novak Djokovic bare-chested on a tennis court? So I ask, is tennis still living in the dark ages?
You'd like to think that it's moved on, and actually, when you look at the Forbes, you know, top highest paid female athletes, 8 of the 10 are tennis players, so something's being done right there. Obviously, it's still not the same levels as the men. And when you think of tennis, you do think of it as a sport for men and women. So I think in a lot of ways it is at the forefront of promoting equality in sport. But then again, there's incidents like this which show there's still a little bit of a way to go.
Yeah, because you say that, and we always think of tennis as being one of the great sports for equality. You look at equal prize money and things like that, but then you also throw out the fact that women play 3 sets, whereas men play 5 sets. We've talked about that in the past as well. But I think if anything this week has shown is that it isn't equal, and that we continually judge what women tennis players are wearing probably a bit too much as a society.
I don't think what's happened over the last couple of weeks shows that tennis is actually in the dark ages. It shows that there's a few people running the game who are potentially still a bit in the dark ages, but I don't think it reflects tennis as a whole. I mean, this guy is the president of the French Federation, but he's not, you know, the president of the ITF or the WTA or anything like that. He's just one bloke who runs a Grand Slam. And yes, he's stuck in the dark ages, but, you know, there's so many other great tournaments where, you know, women can pretty much wear what they want. Why we should be focusing on them, the fact that he is in the minority.
You mentioned that guy, Giudicelli.
I couldn't say his name, so I didn't want to try.
I don't even know if I'm saying that right, to be honest. And Annalise Cornet said herself that he lives in another time, and that what he said about Serena's catsuit was 10,000 times worse than what actually happened to her at the US Open.
I think what happened to Cornet at the Elise Open, she's come out and said, was a mistake. I mean, her phrase was the umpire was a bit overwhelmed by the situation. It was a bit weird suggesting that the umpire was overwhelmed by a woman taking her top off, which I don't think is what she meant, but could have been could have been like that. But I think that was just one of those where someone has been a little bit baffled by the situation and made a mistake, and they've since come out, clarified the rules and apologised. So I think that we can move on. Well, not necessarily move on from that, but I think that one, from her perspective, has been dealt with. But this incident over the catsuit is much, I agree with her, should be much more of an issue, because basically you're telling women what they can and can't wear to play sport, which is wrong. And that's something that was wiped out years ago, really.
So are we looking at maybe there's more of an issue at the top level in the organisation side of the game? Because on the face of it, the tennis organisational structure is very archaic. You've got the ATP, ITF, WTA, the list goes on, of all these different bodies constantly conflicting with one another, and by and large, not wanting to put everyone who runs those into the same boat, but they seem to be not as willing to modernise as, say, some others are.
It's a weird one because, like you say, in certain elements, tennis is archaic, and even at a club level, it still feels very stuffy, very middle class. But then they're so, as we've talked about before, they're so forward thinking in other areas, so use of Hawkeye and things like that. It's a sport that's really sort of stuck in an evolutionary stage where it's sort of clinging onto its roots, but is forward moving, and hopefully, you know, as time passes, hopefully quickly as well, that these older people will be rooted out of the game and more modern, equal thinking people will come in and run the game, and then we won't have issues like this dogging tennis anymore.
To play devil's advocate, and you look at Giudicelli's comments and how it was about respecting the game, etc. And earlier, I think only about 3 or 4 episodes ago, we praised Wimbledon for sticking to the tradition with the all-white dress code. What's different in terms of we're praising Wimbledon for sticking to their tradition? Why can't the French Open, or the organiser of the French Open, be allowed to stick to what he sees as tradition?
Well, one of the differences is Wimbledon are telling people what colour they can wear or what they can't wear. Basically, they're only allowed to wear white, but they're not saying, you know, you can't wear a catsuit or women have to wear skirts below a certain length. Those rules have, as far as I'm aware, have now been eradicated from Wimbledon and from tennis in general. In this instance, he is telling a woman that she cannot wear a certain type of dress to play tennis, whereas Wimbledon, it's just about the colour, and it's equal for men and women as well. You should never be able to tell a woman what she can and can't wear, really, should you?
That's what I thought. I thought common sense would actually come to play there, particularly for the reasons that Serena Williams was wearing it.
Yeah, in like swimming, when they banned the bodysuits because they were having such an effect on performance, if it was, you know, making her 10 times a better player, then yeah, of course you shouldn't be wearing that sort of thing. But the fact she was wearing it to prevent blood clots, which could kill her, and we all know she's had blood clots previously and earlier in her career, and then with the birth of a child, you know, it's a nonsense. If she needs to wear it for health reasons, then she needs to wear it. You can't discriminate against that.
With Serena Williams in particular, are we looking at this not just purely as a sexism thing, but partly a racism thing as well? Because if you look down the years, Serena in particular has often been criticised for her choice of fashion and things like that. But then you throw her sister Venus Williams into the mix as well, and the two of them have often been critiqued probably a little bit more than some others. Go back to them when they were first starting out on the tennis scene and they had the beaded hair, for example, which is popular amongst African-American communities and things like that. Are we starting to see that maybe turn and disappear, but there's still elements of that where we're critiquing the Williams sisters so much more than others?
So until you'd mentioned it, I hadn't really thought of the whole catsuit banning thing having any racist motives behind it. I just thought it was this bloke being, you know, sexist and telling a woman what she couldn't wear. But I never really thought there was any racial elements behind it. And I don't think, if there is any, I don't think it's intentional. But like you say, over the years, there's been so much criticism of or critiquing of the Williams sisters, not just over what they wear, but also just their general physical appearance as well. And they are breaking the mold. You know, they're black, female, strong, powerful tennis players who don't necessarily fit, you know, the ideal athlete femininity. And people have you know, looked down their noses at them for so long. But I think their performances have shown that, you know, it doesn't really matter what you look like. As long as you're good enough to play, you will win. And that's hopefully what more and more people will start to think going forward. They'll remember Serena and Venus Williams as incredible players who broke the mold and were groundbreaking, and they won't remember them for incidents like this.
We have talked about sexism quite regularly on this podcast.
Almost as regularly as drugs.
And Russia. But, I mean, we look at what's happened with Serena, and we look at what's happened with Elise Cornette, where everyone was apparently shocked about seeing the sight of a sports bra. But why is it important that we call it out when it happens? Some people maybe are arguing that we're reading a bit too much into it.
So, mate, I think you need to call it out because it's such a rarity nowadays that when people do say stuff like this, it shouldn't be acceptable. And when you call it out, those people who have these views will realise that it's not acceptable anymore and will hopefully keep it to themselves and will hopefully just stop people saying things like this in the first place.
Exactly.
Hopefully.
And like you said before, the US Open organisers did regret that she was given a code violation, Elise Cornette, for what happened. And it was probably by calling it out for what it is that we actually got that response. So you actually need to point and say it's not okay solve the problem.
The fact is, the person who this affected the most was Elise Cornette, and she was, you know, she was quoted as saying that she was quite scared that she was going to get a fine, and that, you know, there were other people and in support of her saying, well, you know, if they fine you, we are going to go and start a revolution and stuff like that. And she said, whoa, chill out, I need to get all the information. And she took a very she dealt with it so well. You know, she took her time, got the information, she's found out why she was given the court violation, that she's had the apology, and she's downplayed it. And I think there's the element of, yes, we need to call these things out, but there's also, we need to be realistic. And in that incident, a mistake was made and the person has apologized for it and the rules have been clarified. Yes, we need to call it out, but we don't need to go nuts with it. Whereas the Serena Williams catsuit incident, we should be calling out, we should be quite strong on that, because it's just plain wrong.
Exactly.
And he hasn't come out and he hasn't even explained why it should be banned. He just said, oh, we need to ban it, but hasn't said why. It's just, he's just a very archaic man.
So Serena is now doing her thing at the US Open in a 2-2. Do we read much into that? And maybe her dignified response as well to the whole thing, where she kind of said everything will be okay in the end.
I think she just lets her tennis do the talking, and she doesn't really come out and say much that's controversial. She knows she doesn't need to. I think the 2-2 is a bit of a statement saying, try stopping me wearing this. And yeah, she's just going to let her tennis do the talking, as she always does. She's a very, very classy lady.
As she always does. And it probably won't be the end of it. But we know that Serena Williams will always do her talking on the tennis court, as she has done so for so many years now. Moving on to topic 2. And that is the world of cricket. Namely, what is wrong with England and England's batting? Following the 203-run defeat at Trent Bridge in the third test against India, and another subsequent poor performance in the fourth test that is currently ongoing as we record this, we are asking, once again on this podcast, what is going on? Because if you look over the last 3 years, despite the presence of Alistair Cook and Joe Root, who are, once they're all done and dusted in terms of their England careers, we'll probably look back on them as being two of the best batsmen we've ever had. But the stats don't really look good over the last 3 years, because in 35 of their past 65, they have completed innings since 2015, England have failed to reach 300. Which, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that's kind of a benchmark if you want to be competitive in a test match.
300 used to be a par score. It's now more along the lines of 350 in certain conditions. So
that makes it look even more worse. So what then is the source of the failure? Is it primarily the top order of that batting lineup, which just on the face of it, from an outsider looking in, i.e. me, doesn't look to be up to the task?
It's a mentality thing, first and foremost, amongst the whole batting unit. So Trevor Bayliss was brought in 2015, and there was a lot of criticism hanging around at the time that England played too defensive, too boring a brand of cricket. And there was a little bit, they just lost Andrew Strauss as captain a few years before, and there was a bit of transition and things weren't settled. But, you know, you could rely on England to say in 5 out of 10 innings to get, you know, really, really good score and for the batting unit to all function. Trevor Bayliss was brought in to play more aggressive, more attacking, more exciting cricket and make England, you know, a brilliant team to watch. And in the one-day stuff, he's done that. England are a fantastic one-day team. And initially in the Test match stuff, we were really, really good. 2015, early 2016, actually most of 2016 summer, we were really, really good to watch. Players all over the show producing brilliant performances with bat and ball. Exciting cricket. You have to just think back to Ben Stokes's 250-odd against South Africa, which was just, I was listening to it on the radio, which was incredible, and it was going so well. But now the honeymoon period is finished and things are in a difficult phase, and they're just not adapting their game to the situation. You know, they're playing stupid shots, getting out, their mindsets are scrambled, you know, they're playing balls they shouldn't be playing. There's a few players with technical issues as well. Keaton Jennings, I'm sure everyone's knows that he's just completely screwed at the moment. He came back in at the start of the series, got a nice 48 in the first test and looked in good nick. But then since then, you know, we've gone back to just, he's just a scrambled mind and there's no confidence and it's just running throughout the whole team. Alistair Cook, actually, whereas previously he was criticised for being out of form, not looking good, this series he's continuously looked in really, really good touch. The first three dismissals were just brilliant balls. You can't do a lot about those. But then since then, he's been wafting at shots, guiding the ball into the hands of the slips. There's a mentality issue there, which is really worrying. And to be honest, the only person who's really stood up to the task in the last couple of tests is Ben Stokes. He made 60-odd in the fourth innings last time out alongside Joss Butler's 100, trying to save the game. And reined in his attacking instinct completely, batted sensibly, solidly. His technique is fantastic. And then in the first innings of this game, only made 23, but again, just really battling for the team. And it just feels like no one else is doing that at the moment. Everyone else is giving their wickets away.
This has popped into my head after reading a little bit of cricket writing on the internet on my way in today. And you're better placed to answer this than I am. But in terms of modern batting now in tests, are we now in a phase where it's about trying to attack the bowler and try and get those sweet shots in early doors? Whereas perhaps in the past, can't remember who it was who said it now, it was about hanging in there for the first 45 minutes because you knew the bowler would be on top for those 45 minutes. Stay in there, defend, and then you can start hitting your attacking shots. Is that what we're seeing a little bit?
It's interesting because I have this debate a lot with my dad, and he says, why can't these players who go and whack the ball around in one-day cricket do it in Test match cricket? And it is a hotly debated topic, but it's just different Test match cricket. You've got a ball, for example, in English condition, swings around straight from the off, which you don't get with a white ball. It's a different mentality, a different field settings, different bowlers bowling different plans, different lines. And I think Test match cricket has evolved, but I still think you need those players who are going to stick around and bat for long periods of time. So if you look at the Australian batting lineup, David Warner is a 2020 one-day specialist, and he comes in, he's an attacking Test match player, but he doesn't do it every innings. You know, it really depends on the situation, on the innings you're playing. And in England, unless the bowling is absolute tripe, with the ball moving around, you have to stick around for 45, 50 minutes, get yourself in, and then you have to keep concentrating. And that's the issue England have had this summer, is that Jennings and Cook, a couple of times, have put on 50 partnerships and have got through dodgy periods, and then they relax, and then they get themselves up playing stupid shots. They're not, at the moment, set up to play mentally, set up to play long innings, and that's as a result of many things. There's a too attacking a mindset, too much one-day 2020 cricket. And that's why actually seeing Ben Stokes and Joss Butler in the last game, it was an incredible 100, actually settling down, taking their time, building in innings, and then accelerating towards the end was a joy to watch. And it was also a rarity because England players just don't do that anymore. Even Alistair Cook doesn't do that anymore.
Well, you mentioned Alistair Cook then. Is someone of his calibre, perhaps, on a bit of a decline? Does he look mentally exhausted a little bit?
Yeah. So people before have said technically he looks out of sorts. But as I said, this series he's looked fine. He just keeps And like I said, first three dismissals he got, all Jaffers, you know, you get those in cricket. He was unlucky to get three in three innings. But then since then, he just keeps playing at balls. He doesn't need to play, nicking off to slips, playing shots that he wouldn't have played at his prime. And he looks mentally tired. He looks mentally shattered. I don't know if he needs a rest. I don't know if he maybe just needs to take this winter off from Test match cricket, come back next summer. I don't know what he needs to do, but it's such a shame, you know, our highest ever run scorer not performing as we know he can. And it's disappointing to watch, and it's sad to watch.
Speaking of slips, and someone whose reputation is slipping down ever further, Trevor Bayliss, who is if ever he has listened to this podcast, I know he's not a fan because we've not spoken too highly about him in the past. Is there still an issue there? How long should he hold on to his job for?
Clearly, Trevor Bayliss is a very, very good one day 2020 coach because he's got the best out of a very talented bunch of English cricketers in those formats.
But
we've got a very talented bunch of English cricketers playing Test match cricket. That's not to say, yeah, we are missing, you know, one or two specialist batsmen who can really stick around, especially an opener. But we've got the talent in the county ranks to bring through who should be able to adapt to Test match cricket, and they're not. And that is because of the way the team is set up. And he's just, I don't think he's a very good Test match coach. That was what I was looking for. And I think people are now realising that we'd rather England play a more boring brand of Test match cricket and win. There's a fine line to be had, and you know, Test match cricket is going through changes, is having to adapt to the rigours of competing with 2020 cricket, and the fact that more people want to watch that. But there is also, there are so many people out there who still want to see a Test go for 5 days, see two teams really battling it out, as we did in the first Test. Okay, only went 4 days. But, you know, you couldn't pick a winner for most of that first Test. And this fourth Test seems to be going that way. And we want more of that. And if England do, I would rather see England win in a slightly more controlled, not boring, but a slightly slower paced fashion than losing consistently playing attacking cricket. And he hasn't been able to adapt to that. So he needs to go before next year's Ashes, because we don't want to lose the Ashes on home soil for the first time since 2001. He won't want to leave with that hanging over him. Yes, he's Australian, but he'll want to win. So he's either got to change, or the management has to change him, as in replace him before next year's Ashes, in my opinion.
Forgive my ignorance, but then from a management side of things, why do we not have a specialist 2020 one-day coach, head coach, or then a specialist Test coach?
There should be. That's what a lot of people have been asking recently, and it's incredible to think that I don't think any country has actually gone down that route yet. Australia have trialled it. So when Darren Layman was in charge, he steps aside for a couple of one-day series, and they put Justin Langer in, who is now the overall coach. And I don't see the issue. You know, Test match cricket is completely different to one day in 2020. Have two different people in charge. You often have two completely different squads for those as well. So, you know, it's not like you're going to have one or two, or maybe three or four flitting between the two. But they're also professional cricketers who play at county level, play for other teams in 2020 league. So they'll be used to different coaching setups. The ECB has the money to do it.
I just thought I'd throw that out there. Because
you're not the only one. So many people in the cricketing world have been asking that recently. And I think it's when the next person is brought in, that's what needs to be seriously thought about. We should have a Test match coach and a white ball coach, in my opinion.
That would seem so much more sensible for me, from my perspective.
It does. It's just not been done before, and I think people are a bit scared to do it. But
scared to experiment.
Just do it. I don't see what could go wrong.
Well,
you could be. You could appoint the wrong person for both and be rubbish at both. But this is a too talented bunch. These cricketers are too talented to flop consistently. It's not like the 1990s where we were struggling for serious talent in this country. We have a really good bunch of cricketers and a lot of good players knocking on the door. They just need the right coaching structure to help them through. And I think give it a go. Have separate coaches. Do it.
So if things currently continue as they are continuing, and we do arrive at the Ashes next year in this, with the same sort of setup, how do you see it going?
We will lose.
So that wave of positivity you had for the last tour seems to have disappeared.
You know, see, it's, Australia will, A, have Smith and Warner back, and Bancroft, which makes them automatically stronger than they are at the moment. They've got some really good quick bowlers, and if we're struggling to deal with India's quick bowlers, we will struggle to deal with Australia's quick bowlers, especially Mitchell Starc, who, being left-handed, provides all sorts of different options. Something needs to change. If Bayliss is still in charge but the mentality has changed, then I'll be confident. If Bayliss is not in charge and someone else has come in and the mentality, and someone else from a completely different mould has come in and isn't Andy Flower, I will be confident that we can do a good job. I don't know. We'll see how it goes.
We will see how it goes. Watch this space, everyone. And if they do try that experimental line, I'll be claiming some credit on that. And with that, that concludes our discussion section on episode 27. My goodness, episode 27 of this podcast. But it's, of course, time for athlete feature interview time. And this one is a little bit different, I suppose, to ones we've done in the past, because our guest today, I've known for quite a considerable amount of time because we were at university together and we were fencing teammates together. However, while my fencing career and fitness levels absolutely nosedived after I left, he went in the other direction and has risen through the ranks to become the third ranked Scottish fencer, 23rd in Britain at the moment. A couple of weeks ago, he was selected for the Scottish Commonwealth team, which was a goal he set himself 2 years ago, and he's now accomplished that. So the Commonwealth Games in fencing, for those not in the know, don't happen at the same time as the regular Commonwealth Games. They happen in November.
Why is that?
Because fencing was removed from the programme in favour of lawn bowls several years ago, which we're not bitter about at all.
Well, you aren't.
No. So this November, the fencing Commonwealth Games are taking place in Canberra in Australia. In all seriousness, he has worked incredibly hard for what he's done. So I hope everyone enjoys the interview after this little jingle.
Have you signed up to Banana Crumble, the free online cash prize giveaway? Sign up today at www.bananacrumble.co.uk for your chance to win. Sign up is quick, free and easy. Don't believe us? Hear what some of our winners have had to say.
Winning £50 with Banana Crumble was an amazing feeling. Being a student, it's often hard to get money, so I was able to put it straight towards my rent for second term.
Terms and conditions apply. See website for details. Working alongside the Cystic Fibrosis Trust to raise vital funds for this fantastic cause.
Welcome back, listeners, to another of our athlete feature interviews, and on this episode, we're joined by a fencer who has recently risen through the rankings to be selected for the upcoming Commonwealth Games in Canberra in November. However, what makes this interview slightly different to others we've done, particularly from my perspective, is that he was also a teammate of mine at university for several years, so I've certainly seen him at his worst on several nights out. It's a warm welcome to the show to a certain Anthony Sheck. How are you this fine morning?
I'm fine, I'm good. You know, early mornings are great for me.
Early mornings being 9 o'clock, so you're still living the university lifestyle, clearly. Before I kind of dive into some questioning, I suppose we better touch on how long we've known each other. And I want to say 2013, but I may be wrong, because you were a year below me at university, Uni of Dundee, for those not in the know. And we both fenced the same weapon, which is sabre. And to say we came up against each other a lot is a little bit of an understatement. Was I your biggest nemesis? Please say yes.
certainly for the Dundee team anyway. I don't think we faced each other that many times in domestics, however many we did anyway.
Well, you have no idea how close I came to introducing you as the 2015 Scottish Student Sport Individuals runner-up. because I beat you in that final.
You beat me in that final, yes. But yeah, I would say so. Well, it would be yourself up until you kind of left, where it kind of went up in the air and went, there's nothing else here.
there's just no one else there. So no, while my...
while my fitness and fencing career has taken a nosedive and careened off a cliff, yours is actually going the other way. So, first question, at what point did you decide that you really wanted to take your fencing to the next level?
The point I decided was about the latter end of 2015. We had a Bucks match against Lancaster at that point, I think. They had a couple of like top 50 GB fencers, and I was looking forward to it. Didn't know how well we'd do. We ended up winning it and end up beating one of their top 50 fencers about 5-0 in a team match anyway. But decided I could probably hit that. I was ranked around about 170 at that point. So decided to hit top 50, and then from there decided to aim for 2018 Commonwealths from there.
Yeah, so it's just setting yourself those little goals each time?
Little goals at each time. I think by the end of that season I was 60th in Britain, so, and then later season I was hitting top 50, and now here I am.
Yeah, exactly. What's been then the biggest change, do you think, in your training regime? Because I know you've been doing a lot of fitness work and stuff like that. Is that maybe the biggest difference between you prior and you deciding to take it to the next level?
Yeah, a lot of fitness work. A lot of mental changes, I would say, were the hardest part, especially in this sport, I think. Whereas a lot of kind of individual effort. But you kind of go through a lot of the emotions because you don't end up fencing the way you want to a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think it was a mentality thing more than anything else, because from then on I was getting lessons from Phil Carson, which was a change as well. But doing more competitions, the competitive mindset is a big difference between you bowing out humbly and then you kind of having a bit of a rant to yourself on the piece and trying not to have a tantrum.
Yeah. Is that an easy thing to sort out mental wise? Because I mean, if I remember back to us when we were on the same team and you'd have occasional absolute blinding streaks of form in the same match, but then suddenly it could also change?
Yeah, you go through the motions in fencing when you're just ruining people on different teams, and then you come up against someone who just figures you out, and you just don't know how to switch really. So you end up being stuck. You end up getting stuck in a rut. So I've spent the last couple of, well, especially the last year, I spent time trying to get myself out of that.
Mm-hmm.
Which has worked. The beginning of my season was definitely not great, but now I finished quite strongly. So
yeah, and is that primarily work that you've done with Phil Carson, who runs Salossian up in Perth?
Yeah, it's primarily work I did with Phil. Whenever I came back from a satellite competition or quite a big competition down in either London or Birmingham that I'd be having, I would tell him what my problems were, this and that. And he would speak to me kind of going, well, you can set your mentality to that, or you can just think about it as a positive experience, learn from it, and then just train yourself to see what you could do. But it was a lot of having to reflect as well on it, going, why did I have such a bad time? Why was this? Why was that?
Mm-hmm. Is self-reflection easy?
Not particularly at all. You always think you're a lot better than your result is, and sometimes you are, but it's just about just humble, just being humbled and kind of accepting, yeah, I just didn't bring it today, but I really need to find out why.
Yeah, exactly. So then tell me about your relationship with fencing, because of all the people I came across in the sport, you were probably one of the ones who really loved it without fail. You didn't really have a love-hate relationship with it. I could be wrong there. But how how did you first get into it?
Last year of high school, I was doing Duke of Edinburgh Award. So it was part of my sports activity. Wanted to do something different than signing up for the school hockey team or rugby team, and decided to try fencing. Emailed the university team first, where it was Kirsty.
Yeah, Kirsty.
And she referred me on to the Dundee City Club, where I met Richard. And then from there, I just really enjoyed it. It was a different sport. Met a lot of the uni fencers at that point, so...
Hi.
I think that... Yeah. So I did have a lot to fend against slash kind of build a friendly rivalry with, kind of. Yeah, just a lot of good experiences, a lot of good people. Mm. So it was just an enjoyable sport socially as well.
Yeah, was the sport the primary reason then you decided to go to Dundee Uni?
Yeah, it was actually, because I built up a lot of friendships with people, and I thought, I know a lot of good uni sabre fencing was in Dundee, so I think at that point we were unbeaten in sabre as a team.
I think we were, yeah.
Yeah, so yeah, that was one of the main reasons I wanted to fence really good sabre fences constantly and have a good time as well.
Yeah. I mean, you say you didn't want to join like the hockey team or the rugby team or anything like that. So what is it about the sport of fencing, as it were, that kind of made it the sport for you?
It's always the thing of kind of, it's sword fighting. It's good fun. But it's a different set of skills. You kind of see once you start watching YouTube clips of World Cups or that, and you see how amazing it is, how kind of, I think one of the first things I was exposed to was the 2012 Olympics in London, and watching the men's sabre team finals on TV, and just watching, and it was just the Korean kind of physicality, and they just kind of how different it is from, you know, the classical fencing you see from, like, the European teams. And, it's just different. You don't see most of the same things twice. And when there's a really kind of showboating hit, everyone just goes nuts. So it's just different from kind of rugby, where physicality does matter. You can show off yourself, but you are in the end part of team. But fencing is very individual. It's what you've got.
Yeah, and I can certainly vouch for the going wild when there's a showboating hit. Always love a showboating hit. Now, the rise up the rankings, because you are currently 23rd in Britain in sabre and 3rd in Scotland. So how much work actually goes into getting those ranking points? Because it's not just rocking up at any old competition, is it? You kind of have to pick and choose the toughest of competitions.
Yes. There's a lot of prep into it. It's kind of, you're trying to find out this season, what small changes are happening. So you can have either a slight advantage or you're on the same ground as a lot of people. And then you've got to rock up to kind of satellite competitions, which is it's international. You are representing GB, but you can just enter yourself. These competitions, you see some world rankers, like people who end up in the top 50, who need just those 4 world points that could make their life easier at a at a Grand Prix or a World Cup, and you end up placing them in your pool, and you kind of go, what do I do here? But from what I found, that these guys are really nice, but they are tough. I've had a couple of blinders. I've lost them 5-4, which was a really good boost for my confidence there. But you end up having to think, I just need to win these number of fights. I'll get into the top 75%, and from there I can work.
Going to all these competitions that you are now going to, compared to, say, your Scottish Opens of the past, what's the biggest thing you take away and learn about yourself? Which is a very big question.
It is a big question. I would take away how did I lose hits, which is an important thing, but it's more importantly kind of where was my mind at when I actually won my fights? Because at some point, I think you would agree that you have this moment of kind of forgetting everything around you, and you're just concentrating on, you know, you're still standing there on the line, and then you're just waiting for the referee to tell you to just go nuts.
to put it in a way. That's a very apt description of it.
Yeah, especially in Sabre, where everything can be decided in just the first half a second of them telling you on guard, pray, alley, and you just go, and then you just know you have to go. And I always reflect back on how did I win hits, but more importantly, kind of how did I win that fight? Where was my state of mind at that point?
Mm-hmm.
Because when I try to find myself thinking about something too much, I step out of that zone, if you think, and I'm not ready, and then I get hit. I'm really confused about myself, kind of going, why did that happen? I had a rally of 5 or 6 hits. So what changed about it? And then when you start forgetting about it, you're just going, I'm just going to concentrate on it. You end up slipping back into it somehow. And it's a really confusing thing to try and grasp. But that's something I've been taking on board especially from my last competition, which was in Iceland. I was the top ranked Brit there, especially when there was a couple of people from the top 10 and in the top 20 in GB there, higher ranked than me, but somehow overtook them. And it's been something that I've been trying to put in my mind anyway.
Yeah, exactly. So then we come to the Commonwealth call-up, which you said you'd set yourself as a goal, and then it happened a few weeks ago. Is that the best moment you've had in the sport? Other than competing with me, obviously.
Obviously. Best moments, to be selected for Scotland to go to Commonwealth and Canada is an amazing achievement, I think, for myself, especially once I kind of set it about 2 years ago. 2 years is not that long to prepare when you kind of think people prepare for the Olympics as soon as the Olympic cycle starts.
Yeah, it's a 4-year thing.
And starts, yeah. So it's a lot to change, a lot to kind of catch up with other people who've been preparing as well. I would say it's one of my top moments to be selected, but it still kind of doesn't feel real yet because I'm not over there in Australia. I've not competed doing it. I've not had just the entire thing in front of me, so it's still kind of, and just hard training, keeping myself kind of on the ground,
yeah,
rather than in the clouds.
Is that kind of the next thing then, is waiting for it to actually arrive and for you to get over there?
Yeah, absolutely. It's waiting for it getting to actually be there. So I would say it's one of my top moments.
But once it actually happens, that'll probably surpass that.
That'll probably surpass it, yes. Mm-hmm. Just being able to represent my country would be great.
Yeah, exactly. And then you're doing it in a team which has got a lot of familiar names for those in the know about Scottish fencing. Tom Hoffman, Neil Tannock, two examples. But does that kind of make it a little bit easier then that once you get over there, there's a lot of familiar faces that you can turn to for advice if you need advice?
Absolutely. Yeah, I know a lot of the Scottish team. I know a lot of the juniors that have come up there as well. It's, it'll be a little bit less of a starstruck moment for me, kind of going, okay, I know most of the people here. Hopefully training with the Sabre team a bit in the next coming weeks up until Commonwealth, and just kind of settle into it, get familiar, get relaxed rather than panicking about what's going to happen.
Yeah, exactly. So now kind of come on to the funding aspect as well, which
yes.
Obviously fencing is not the cheapest of sports to do. And you've set up a crowdfunding page to try and help you in this Commonwealth Games goal of yours. Is that when you've got the funding thing, as well as the training and the fitness and the mental training as well, is that just another thing that you kind of have to juggle with it all? And is it also difficult?
Funding is difficult, especially in the last year. Taking all these trips to Amsterdam, to down to London, back and forth.
Well, Iceland as well. You just saying.
Iceland flights as well, which aren't the cheapest. But it's something I've had to deal with anyway. Throughout university, I was working part time, so I was pretty much nearly fully supported myself. Before, if anything breaks, then I really hope nothing broke. You have to replace it yourself. I didn't really want to burden my parents by asking them for kind of, can I get some money to replace my fencing equipment? So I think working part-time as well, just increasing my hours at this point. But it's not been the biggest setback for me at all, because I've just been used to it.
Yeah, because you've been doing it for so long.
I've been doing it for the last 5-6 years. But the crowdfunding was something that was mentioned when I was working with my personal trainer. He said, you can set up a crowdfunding page. It can take a bit of the stress off of you to fully kind of fund yourself. So I decided to make a crowdfunding page.
Yeah, just to give yourself a little bit of peace of mind.
A little bit of peace of mind. This is enough money that I can cover probably a mask or a glove or some form of replacement, and it doesn't come out of what I've used, and I can spend that money somewhere else, kind of on flights or on travel.
Yeah, because so. I suppose such is the world. You just know that between now and the start of the games, something will break.
Something will break, and
it will be expensive.
You have to replace it as quick as you can.
Not just career highlights, but do you have sort of favourite moments in fencing? Because I look back at us, and I always think that our uni time was probably the most fun we had.
Favourite times in fencing was definitely, I think it was in my first year, somehow coming out of pools and then finishing top Scott was probably one of them somehow. I still don't remember how that happened, because you had so many people, so many good people there. It was yourself, Andrew Williamson, Adam Cruikshank there, is going, where did this come from?
Because I mean, there was a lot of talent amongst the Scottish team, Sabre-wise, yes. Particularly.
One of my favourite moments was getting through to my first 16 at a satellite event, which was last year in Iceland. So Iceland's been very kind to me in the last while. I have two last 16s in Iceland. This year in particular was really necessary, because I was fifth in the Sabre rankings. I was kind of discretionary, so I had to do every competition. So I had the Leon Paul one the night before. As soon as Leon Paul finished, get the flight to Iceland, navigate through London somehow through Google, and then get into the airport on time to chuck my bag on and go, I'm going to Iceland, to get there for midnight Iceland time.
It's a hectic life, isn't it?
It is a hectic life when you're chasing points.
Exactly. Training-wise, work-wise, and then competition-wise, what happens between now and the Commonwealth Games actually starting?
So lots of the training-wise, it's more of the same thing, just increasing how much I'm actually training at the moment. Just fitting that around work. Just increasing my number of hours of work. So I do have a week planned out of training. So 3 nights of training, and then my own fitness stuff on top of that. 2-3 nights of work, which are can range from about 6 to 8 hours each night. And then just working, doing the Scottish Commonwealth training. So I actually get to fence with my teammates. Some of them I've fenced with before at Senior Five Nations, but we'll see how all of it works together.
And yeah, we'll see how it goes. Yeah.
See how it goes, yeah.
And with that, we better wrap up this latest interview, and thank you again for coming on to the podcast and telling us about it, because I know you've worked incredibly, incredibly hard to actually make that team. So when it does come around in November,
yes,
I hope it all goes well, but first and foremost that you enjoy that experience, and we'll certainly be flying the flag, the Scottish flag, I should probably clarify, over at this end as well. So all the best, and thanks so much for coming on.
Cheers, no problem. Thanks for having me.
So thanks again to Tony for coming on to the podcast as our guest, and I hope everyone enjoyed, as always, our interviews. Same as before, let's point you in the direction of our social media pages. We're on Facebook, Instagram, and on Twitter. Also, fun fact, I managed to get the Twitter account suspended for a day this week for being underage. It asked me for the birthday, so I put in April 20th, 2017, and it banned it for being under the age of 13.
How did you get it unsuspended?
I had to submit a copy of my driver's license. Social media do's and don'ts. That's a don't right there, everyone. You can also get in touch with us by email. Our email address is sportsbillpod@gmail.com. In terms of what's coming up next, we have some things. What's up next in the immediate future?
Lunch. Also, lunch. I have an interview for the next podcast,
which will be episode 28.
Yep. And then we have already recorded our special interview for our 50th ever episode.
Yes. Ignore the fact that our numbers are a little bit jumbled, because if you include all of our regular episodes as well as our special episodes, the episode in 2 episodes' time will be the 50th one we ever did, which is a milestone that we thought we'd commemorate with a very special guest.
A very big name.
Yes, but we'll keep it secret for now. Can't give away too much already.
All I'm going to say is, I'm jealous that I didn't speak to this person.
Sorry. But you have done the next one, so.
I have got a very big name for our next one as well.
Exactly.
So.
We're all about the names. We'll be back in 3 weeks, because you're going on your Hollybobs.
Yep.
Where are you going?
Cornwall.
Nice. We're going to do sunbathe.
Eat, sleep, surf.
Rave, repeat.
Eat, sleep, surf, repeat.
Not bad. There are going to be some surfing pictures of you to arrive on Facebook afterwards.
No, because we all go as a family. So no one's going to be there to take photos.
No worries. I have no holiday booked for the next 3 weeks. I'm just going to be, you know,
crying to yourself. Crying yourself to sleep.
Sitting in the corner of the office going, what on earth going on? That sounded very depressing. Don't worry, I'm more happy than that. But yes, with that, that is the end of this episode. Join us in 3 weeks' time, where we have more discussion, more feature interviews for you. But until then, have fun, everyone. Bye-bye.